BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hi there, welcome to the podcast Health Check. I'm Claudia Hammond, and every week we dissect the latest health and medical news for you. Today, I face my fears.
Would you feel uncomfortable if a spider crawled out of your shoe?
Yes.
When you see a spider, do you feel tense and restless?
Yes.
Do you feel sick when you see a spider?
Yes.
Do you shudder
Disgusting,
when you...
Disgusting, yes.
Do you shudder when you think of spiders?
Yes.
I try out a new treatment to discover whether my own heartbeat can be used to help me overcome my fear of spiders. And thermostat wars. Men tend to prefer an office to be cool, while women like it warmer. Could this affect the mental performance of women and men? And BBC Health and Science correspondent James Gallagher is back in the Health Check studio today. Now, I want to start with you, James, by asking you about the news of the first cases of Ebola in Uganda. Of course, this is what people have feared, that the current outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo might spread across the border. How much do we know?
So we know that a family moved across the border from the DRC to Uganda, and not long after they arrived there, just a couple of days, a five-year-old boy was taken to hospital. He had signs and symptoms of Ebola, including vomiting blood. So he was moved to a specialist Ebola treatment centre. That boy has subsequently died, but have now been reported cases elsewhere within the family. The grandmother and a younger brother of the boy are also being treated for the disease. So this is the first cases and the first death in Uganda because of this outbreak.
And how much of a surprise is it that this has happened and that the disease is now in Uganda in these people?
In some ways, I suppose the surprise is that it's taken so long. We know there have been a huge number of cases. The second largest outbreak of Ebola in history happening is close to the border. Both Rwanda and Uganda have been preparing for cases. 4,500 healthcare workers in Uganda have been vaccinated in anticipation of something like this happening. Specialist Ebola treatment centres have been set up in case there are cases. So it's not a surprise. It was planned and prepared for. The big question in the coming days and weeks is how many more cases are there going to have been? Because it's suspect the family have come into contact with 50 or so other people. Have they transmitted the virus to those people as well? These would be questions that we need answering very quickly.
And there's also an epidemic of measles that's been declared in the DRC with 87,000 suspected cases. How worrying is that on top of everything else?
Well, measles is still a deadly disease. 1,500, mostly children, have died from measles in the DRC so far this year. And this is what happens with measles. If you're not vaccinating enough people, and in poor countries, the problem is just getting access to the vaccine in the first place. If not enough vaccine is given, then every so often you get these huge booming epidemics. And that's what's happening in DRC. It's got nothing to do with Ebola. It's just very unfortunate timing that healthcare workers are dealing with both at the same time.
Thanks, James. And we'll talk a bit later about whether we're likely to see more of these large outbreaks around the world in the future. Before all that, spiders. Like many people, I really, really don't like them. Just seeing pictures of one makes me shudder, and I close my eyes when they're on nature programmes. I can recount endless stories of the time I drank a glass of water next to my bed, felt something in my mouth that felt like a live spider, and then realised it was. All the time I accidentally put my foot into a tarantula hole in the rainforest. I have loads more of these stories. I've hated spiders for as long as I can remember. But could a new technique that's been trialled at Sussex University in the UK change all that? It combines an old, well-established method with a brand new idea centred around our heartbeats. Professor Sarah Garfinkel did mention on Twitter that she was seeking out her trusty tarantula in time for my visit, so I entered the lab rather warily to take part in some testing.
So, first of all, we're going to see how close you'll go to a spider.
Yes. Is it dead or alive?
It is dead.
Oh, okay.
So if I told you it was in that...
In this cupboard?
In that cupboard.
Okay.
Would you open the cupboard?
I suppose I'll open the cupboard, because you said it's dead. Yeah. Is it in something?
Yes.
Okay. Then I'll open the cupboard.
So it's in here. Would you take it out the box? If you don't want to, that's fine, but it's in a sort of box within a box.
So there's a box, there's like a cardboard box?
Yeah.
It depends how big it is.
Can you look?
Oh, that's horrible. No, so I'm not touching that.
Okay. All right, we'll leave it there. In classic exposure therapy, what we would do to someone who's phobic of something is that we would show them what they're phobic of repeatedly and do a sort of systematic desensitization where you see it repeatedly, learn it safe, and ultimately extinguish your fear response, that is, get rid of your fear response. And we can do that just by showing you pictures of the phobic object, in this case a spider, or using a real life spider and seeing how close you'll go to it. And we're going to sort of combine the two here.
Okay.
Where we're going to do systematic desensitization, showing you repeatedly pictures of spiders and then seeing if you're at the end prepared to approach the spider. Yeah, I'm going to stick
two
electrodes just on your sort of shoulders. Okay. What makes this special is that we're going to use signals from your heart to try and make it faster for you to overcome your fear. We're going to be presenting spiders in time with your heart signals.
That's the really extraordinary bit, because it seems almost impossible to see how can using signals from my heart make any difference to this.
And this is what I love about the heart. It's such an incredible organ, because it's in dynamic communication with your brain. And what is fear? Fear is a product of your heart pounding and parts of your brain and neural activity firing, giving you the fear response together. And actually, if we can tap into those signals, let you feel fear in a controlled way, you can then hopefully learn it safe faster, and you can then reduce your fear response faster.
So weirdly, you're actually using the heartbeats to make it scarier rather than less scary.
That's exactly right. Mm. That's really the right way of seeing it. So going into the fear and learning it safe helps you extinguish the fear, whereas avoiding the fear allows the continuation of the fear to propagate.
You're going to be presented with a series of images of spiders and other abstract shapes. Occasionally, you'll be prompted to rate the intensity of the picture on a visual scale. You can move the marker position by using the left and right arrow keys. You have 3 seconds to decide. It's like a computer game. Ugh, that was horrible. How intense were they? Oh, yes, they were intense. That's a fat one. Oh, that's an interesting, it's a weird shape. That was a tarantula. Quite a lot of tarantulas on here, I'm noticing. Yeah. Not that many little tiny, tiny money spiders.
Yeah, we're hitting you with the most scary ones.
Yes, I see.
Are your intensity levels going down?
Actually, I'm weirdly sort of getting used to the... I don't like that one being flashed at me until there's a really horrible tarantula-y one. The others don't seem so intense.
But that's great. That's great that your intensity levels are going down. Mm. And the idea is that your intensity levels are going to go down faster because they're being time-locked to your heart signature. Perfect. So you are through your first exposure session.
Okay. I just did that for a few minutes there, but how long would people do a session of this for each time they came?
So each session took about 15 to 20 minutes, and we would have 4 sessions. And we found that that was effective at significantly reducing people's spider phobia scores.
That is amazing, really, that just looking at pictures flashed on a screen, because I know it can't come anywhere near me, but it's just the idea that you just get used to it and you just stop thinking it's so disgusting and horrible and scary.
Because avoidance is so much part of a phobia. People just avoid the stimulus so much that their fear can increase or stay the same through this avoidance, where you imagine all the terrible things, and actually being forced to look at them and interact with them, and then you see it's not that bad. That really does help facilitate the extinguishing of the fear response.
And how much faster does it make it, because it's coinciding with the heartbeat, than if you were to just try doing this normally? Can people come for fewer sessions, or is it that it's more effective?
It's that it's more effective. It's that in 4 briefish sessions we're seeing a significant reduction, which is a meaningful clinical drop in the spider phobia questionnaire, and a significant propensity to actually go closer to our tarantula relative to when the spiders are not time locked to your heart signatures. So now you've finished a session of this exposure therapy, I want to see how prepared you are to have a look at our tarantula again.
We could have a possible look at it. Has it got a name?
No, but would you like to give it a name?
I don't know. I'd probably have to see it to be able to name it, to see what sort of name it needed.
Brilliant. That's a great incentive for you actually to have a look. So would you like to get it out the box, or would you like me to?
I'd like the whole box to come out onto the side.
Okay, I'll do that.
Oh, Terry. It's got a name now.
It's got a name. So would you like me to take it, Terry, out the box, or would you like to have a go?
I've got a ham with a microphone in it.
Okay,
so,
that's
so
a
you
great
do that.
Excuse. So I'm going to take Terry and put Terry here. Are you prepared to go a bit closer to Terry?
Yes, because it's dead. Oh, it's a little bit like a sort of little crab. It's quite a little one.
Although Terry is slightly small, he's very hairy.
Yes, and he's got those disgusting bent legs.
Yeah, so I think the fact that you're looking quite this closely is a wonderful sign.
Well, that's true, actually. Since I wasn't going to get it out of the cupboard before, now I am quite close to it. Obviously, it's not out of its thing, because that would be too far.
Would you like to touch Terry?
I don't think I could touch Terry. Will you touch Terry?
No.
But my PhD student, James, would come in and touch Terry.
Yeah, he can poke Terry.
So shall I get James in to poke Terry?
Yeah. I'll poke Terry.
Oh, the producer's... It's all right, the producer's going to poke
the
Terry.
The producer's going to poke
Are you
going to
poke Terry with a pen or with your finger? So Pam, the producer's having a go. You're very brave, Pam.
Is it that leg?
It might fall off.
Oh!
Well
done.
You're very brave.
That was brave. Do you want to...
You didn't really like doing it, though, did you?
I don't mind doing it.
I'm not touching it. No. I'm not touching
it. That's fair enough. You only had one exposure session, so maybe if we gave you more.
So if I had more, then I might touch it, yes.
Well, you're welcome back any time.
Okay. Thank you very much. We'll see what happens when I encounter the next spider in the shed now.
I'm closing the box and leaving Terry in peace.
Terry's going away now in his box. Sarah Garfinkel. I was very brave, don't you think, James?
Oh, very definitely, Claudia. Has it worked?
Well, I was in the shed and I came across some spiders the other day. And at first, the little ones, I just sort of thought, oh, yeah, whatever, spiders. And I wouldn't have thought that before. I did then see a bigger one and I got out of the way, but I didn't panic. So maybe I may need a top up. I only did a very short time compared with what other people
do. I very cruelly tested you before the programme with a picture of
spiders. I kept showing pictures of spiders, but I thought from a distance that they were crabs.
Well, that's
so
what I assumed
bothered.
Your therapy had done. They'd reprogrammed your brain to think spiders were crabs now.
Now, let me ask you about some other new research out on one of our favourite subjects this week, James. Larks and owls. So, of course, some people wake early and go to bed early. Others of us prefer to get up late and go to bed late. Others are in between. But a new study has found that people's body clocks can be shifted. What have they done here?
Yeah, this is two owls in the studio once again discussing the body clock, isn't
again.
It? So there was a series of measures that people in this trial were asked to do. So they were told to get up 2 to 3 hours earlier in the morning and go to bed 2 to 3 hours earlier in the evening. Every day, getting up and going to bed at exactly the same time every day. Then a couple of other things that help to reinforce the body clock. So eating breakfast incredibly early, getting a lot of light exposure early in the morning to help set the body clock, only exercising in the morning, eating meals at the same time every day, and avoiding things like caffeine in the evenings, and definitely no naps.
But isn't this down to genetic variation? So at the end of the study, which wasn't that long, and there weren't that many of them, won't they just revert and go back to getting up late again, just as people who've looked after kids for 20 years revert when they can and get up late if they want to?
I think you're right, but I don't think that's entirely the point of what they were trying to do in the study. So everybody is hardwired to live a certain way. You can't fight your body clock. It's like trying to tell a teenager they need to get up at 5 a.m. It's just not going to happen because teenagers' body clocks drift very late and then come back down through your 20s. What this is more trying to do is, can you take somebody who is hardwired to have a late body clock and make it easier for them to function in society? Because we have a world that forces you to work at 9 to 5. You know, it's a lark's world. All of us owls suffer
certainly
because
is.
Of it. So what this study is about is, can you drift people's body clocks more in tune with that kind of larkish world?
Fair enough. Now let me ask you something. Have you ever worked in a big open plan office where there were thermostat wars, where the women wanted the room warmer and the men wanted the room cooler?
I work in a massive office where there are thermostat wars because the thermostat doesn't work. That's
my
life
today. Then you can all just war. You can all fight. Well, this can be a particular problem in air-conditioned offices, with some wanting it freezing and others bringing in fleeces to wear because they're so cold. And it's often the women who feel the cold more, or it certainly is in my office.
I tend to feel really quite cold, even if it's the height of summer. I'm always wearing under-the-knee socks, not short socks. And, yes, I tend to wear tights under trousers. And I always wear a vest. Even if it's a heat wave, I will always wear a vest.
I pretty much always feel cold in the office. I'm frequently wearing a sweater. My colleague has a hot water bottle in her desk because she too feels the cold like me. And I went out and actually bought us both blankets quite recently because we were both moaning and feeling cold. So, but they're in corporate colours, you know, they're quite smart blankets. I think it would be nice to be able to work without wearing loads and loads of clothes. Sometimes you have a nice T-shirt on. You want to show people your nice T-shirt, but it's just hidden beneath the sweater. It never comes out to play.
I often feel cold when I come into the office, so I actually have a scarf in my top drawer. Sometimes in the summer when the air conditioning kicks in, it feels very icy. I actually get irritated and annoyed that I'm cold, and I get that uncomfortable that I want to walk out of the room. So that's when I have to go outside to get warm, and then I come back in again.
Now, it's all about comfort, of course, but could it have an impact on performance too? New research from the WZB Berlin Social Science Centre suggests that maybe it can. In the lab, Dr. Agne Kayak-Skiete varied the temperature without telling people and gave women and men a series of mathematical and verbal tasks to do. I asked Agne how much of a difference the temperature made.
A lot. Actually, we were surprised. So for men, not much, but a lot for women. So we didn't expect that effect to be over there. So, for example, in the math task, 1 Celsius increase in the temperature led to 1.76% better performance for women. So the hotter it got, the better they got. The same holds true for the verbal task. There, the effect was a bit smaller, but still very significant. So with each Celsius increase in temperature, they got 1.03% better. For men, on the other hand, they got worse and worse, but just a little bit. So in the math and verbal task, in both, they became 0.6% worse when it got warmer. So what we find is that at the beginning, when it's really cold, like when it's 16 Celsius, men are so much better, for example, in the math task, like the gender gap is huge. They're so much better. And then it gets warmer and warmer and warmer. And at some point, women catch up to men. The same holds true for the verbal task. In the verbal task, women actually outperform men very fast when it gets hotter.
So a 1.76% increase sounds quite small.
Yes, but it sums up. So when we have females solving math tasks and the temperature is lower than like 18 Celsius, they solve around like 8 or 9 tasks. When you go up from 20 to 25, the increase would be like around 8%.
Oh, I see. That's worth having.
So this is a lot.
So I'd say an 8% increase on your performance is worth having.
It's a lot, right?
Yeah. So what do you think's going on here? Do you think that the women are prevented from doing as well as they might at the beginning because they are just feeling so cold?
Exactly. So like the whole discussion before that, like the battle for the thermostat was about the comfort level, about the preferences. It was clear that women prefer higher temperatures. So we are not biologists, but we know that from biology that women feel colder in the same temperature as men. So for example, like right now, I'm feeling a little bit colder than Felix here in the studio.
Right. And you're particularly cold. Oh, no, you're warm. We've made you turn the air conditioning off because the air conditioning is noisy, actually. So you'll warm up nicely.
I'm warming up, yes, that's true.
But Felix is helping. It's going to be too hot, isn't he?
Yes, it'll be too hot very fast, yes.
So what's the answer? If we put the thermostat up in the office so that everyone's a bit warmer, that will benefit the women, but then would that put the men at a disadvantage?
So, first of all, it's one study. Like, we had 540 people. It's a lot. But those are specific tasks, like math and verbal tasks. And it's not that everybody's performing the same task in the office. However, it's still a good proxy for what would happen. What we are saying, you should not, like, take the numbers literally. You cannot say, like, okay, now I will increase the temperature by 5 Celsius degrees, and so women will be 8% better, right? That's not what we are saying with the study. However, what we are saying in the study, that if we have the temperature around like 24 or 25 Celsius, women and men would perform on a similar level. That's what we find in our studies. So when we are like somewhere in the middle of the whole range, women and men were very, very close to each other. However, the main message is that this whole battle for the thermostat is not just about the comfort and that people should take it seriously. And I'm happy we did a study because now people can go to their bosses and say, look, this is like a real thing. It's not only the comfort.
Now, we're often told these days that for the sake of the environment, we should turn down the thermostat by a degree. Now, of course, that's going to advantage the men, isn't it?
The idea came from the environments in the US. So we lived in the US when we started this project, and it's really way too cold. So it's like 16, 17 Celsius in the office. So if we turn off the thermostat, we will save the energy, right? So we are like in
I see what you mean. You're talking about air-conditioned offices, which are often freezing. Yes,
yes, exactly.
People bring in a cardigan, especially to put on at work or more than that.
Exactly, more than that. So they have like foot heaters under the desk. They have blazers. The New York Times reporter, she told me she has like a sleeping bag in her office. she sometimes stays in the sleeping bag.
Oh, dear, sleeping bag. Poor thing.
Yes, so I mean, I think that lots of energy waste is coming there. Like turning off the thermostat a little bit, like having not 17 in the office, like not like 18 Celsius in the office, but like 20 something would actually save the energy. So it goes in the other direction, actually.
Agnè Kayax-Kiété, you're listening to Health Check from the BBC with me, Claudia Hammond. Now, when women are pregnant, they release more of a hormone called relaxin, which relaxes the ligaments in the pelvis to aid childbirth. An orthopaedic surgeon in the US noticed that when his patients had stiff, frozen elbows, they eased during and after pregnancy. He wondered whether relaxin could be the reason. So a team conducted a study, only in rats at the moment, to see whether injections of relaxin could help with the condition frozen shoulder, which affects 2 million people in the US alone. Connective tissues around the joint become thickened and stiff, causing pain and making it hard to move. But in rats with frozen shoulder, the relaxin injections seem to work. Mark Grinstaff, Professor of Biomedical Engineering, Chemistry and Medicine, told me what they did.
What we did is we gave a local injection of this hormone into the shoulder. And the idea is if we give multiple injections of this hormone, maybe we could reverse the disease in this condition. And what we found was twofold. First, that we saw an improvement in the range of motion. So in other words, the rat arm could move in the proper directions and with the proper freedom, just like a normal healthy rat would do. And then when we did histology and looked at the synovial joints, the joint space, in frozen shoulder, what you see is this buildup of tissue. And that buildup of tissue, it kind of blocks the way in which the shoulder can move. And in the relaxin-treated animals, we actually saw a decrease in that. And so that fibrotic collagenous tissue buildup had reduced. And so not only did we actually improve the movement in the shoulder, but we actually reversed the condition and we no longer had that buildup. And I think for us, that was, you know, really a striking observation in the lab. Because today, for example, if you have frozen shoulder, what they will typically do is give you some painkillers and physical therapy. And of course, that only addresses the pain that's associated with frozen shoulder. And it doesn't actually address the underlying cause of the disease, which is this tissue buildup. So, you know, this is one of those cases where it was a really good day in the lab and a really good day for research.
And in a way, it sounds so plausible that this would work. You slightly wonder why no one's tried this before. Has no one tried giving humans relaxin for muscular problems before?
No. So for musculoskeletal diseases, it hasn't been looked at. But there are other conditions, other diseases where people have looked at using relaxin to break down fibrotic tissue. And so there is precedence in other diseases. And then we actually do give relaxin during pregnancy if it's needed to help in the childbirth process. And so, again, there's some precedence for this, but it has not been explored in the musculoskeletal area. And, you know, for us, that opens this large area of musculoskeletal diseases where, you know, one has stiff and, you know, frozen joints. And does this provide us a way to think about really treating those diseases?
Now, the next step, of course, will be to do some trials in humans. Could there be any problems with having too much relaxin? In a way, you know, this is just for if people are about to give birth and the body needs to be looser and the body needs to be able to open up, but maybe we don't want it to do that the rest of the time.
Yes, no, I think that's an excellent question. So you certainly don't want to overdose the patient and, you know, have all your joints kind of be loose because you need those joints to be able to function properly. And so there are two things that need to be done. One is that we need to make sure that we can titrate the dose, give the appropriate amount that has the beneficial effect without having side effects. And then the other approach is to make sure that we do a local injection. And so the idea here is if we locally inject into the joint space, that'll keep a high concentration of relaxin in the joint so that it can perform its job. But the concentration within the rest of the body will be quite low, and so that'll minimize any types of side effects. And I think this is a better strategy for treatment than doing, for example, just an oral tablet or an IV injection where the entire body will see the relaxin. But given that relaxin is already present in the body, this is something that we think is very reasonable to do.
Mark Grinstaff, and of course human trials will take a few years, but it will be interesting to see what happens. Now, James, before we go, we were talking earlier about big disease outbreaks at the start of the programme, and the World Health Organization has said that this kind of thing might be the new normal. Why is that?
Yeah, well, we've had the two biggest Ebola outbreaks in human history in the past 3 years. The West African outbreak affected more than 28,000 people, and as we've been talking about at the beginning of the programme, the current one in the DRC. So I asked the World Health Organization what is going on, and they say that, yes, this might be the new normal, and there's a worrying convergence of risks all around the world, which are increasing the risks of outbreaks happening in the first place. And then once they do happen, the dangers of them becoming much bigger. And that's things like climate change, which can increase the risk of flooding and bringing cholera, but also large and highly mobile populations are making disease spread much easier. There's new diseases emerging, things like Nipah and chikungunya that we've talked about before, and just exploitation of the rainforest, being much closer to the animal reserves where these diseases naturally are before they come over into the human population. And then weak governments and conflicts all making it very hard to deal with these outbreaks when they do happen. All of those happening together is what the World Health Organization is saying is the problem.
And they've got 9 emergencies at their highest grade at the moment, haven't they?
Yeah, that ranges from cholera in Mozambique and Yemen to the Rohingya crisis and Ebola as they're currently dealing with in the DRC. So yeah, they say this is the most they've been dealing with in a long time.
This all sounds very gloomy, but what can be done about it?
I think the focus is then going to have to shift from respond to whatever the latest emergency is and more towards preparing for the inevitable when it's going to happen. Many of these things are predictable. You can see how populations are changing around the world. You can see where the effects of climate change are likely to be, and making sure you've got everything in place for when something does happen, like having a reserve of Ebola vaccine, which has had an undoubted impact on this outbreak. It would be much worse in the Democratic Republic of Congo without a vaccine. So there are steps that you can do to prepare the world for these big outbreaks rather than just trying to react all the time.
Well, do listen out next Wednesday when I'll be here with a special hour-long programme on vaccination, asking why that despite the medical evidence, there's a recent reluctance among some particular groups to get vaccinated and what psychology can tell us about how to allay people's fears. Thanks very much, James Gallagher, and thanks too to the producer, Helena Selby. You can find me on Twitter at Claudia Hammond. Do join me for more from Health Check from the BBC at the same time next week. And if you're looking for another podcast, how about People Fixing the World, with the clever solutions that people are finding to the world's problems. From the ambitious project to swap mosquitoes that spread disease with ones that don't, to the company where people are working less for the same pay but getting the same amount of work done. Find out how by searching for People Fixing the World wherever you found this podcast. Bye for now.